last place most of us would look to shed light on money matters is the funny pages of the newspaper. But cartoons can actually teach us a lot about the state of the economy. Good morning. I'm George Bodarkey, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Coming up on this morning's show, the economy in cartoons. The cartoon editor of the New Yorker magazine joins us to talk about the funny side of finance. Also today, uncovering New York City's wild side, conquering New York City one slice of pizza at a time, and how'd you like a nice Bronx pop? The colorful characters behind a new brand of soda join us later this half hour. That's all coming up on Cityscape. Glad you're with us. When we want to get a read on the economy, most of us pick up a copy of the Wall Street Journal. But the New Yorker, known for its essays, fiction, and humor, also has a lot to say about money. Just take a look at the magazine's history of cartoons on the subject. Many of them are included in a new collection put together by New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff. I talked with Bob earlier this week. Did the idea for this collection come before the current economic downturn or after?
It came about 2 minutes after.
2 minutes after, huh?
No, I mean, we had done, you know, we had cartoon books on money and the like. And, of course, we had the complete cartoons in the New Yorker, which looked at all 70,000 cartoons. But when the big economic downturn happened again, I happened to do a lot of presentations and stuff. And I was looking at the cartoons we had done, and it was so interesting to me how they had actually mirrored the mood of the economy as it's on the upswing up to 1929. There's a guy on an operating table, you know, giving instructions to the surgeon about what to tell his broker. By 1932, you have Wall Street guys in prison in a cartoon. And interestingly, in 1934, you have two men talking, and one is talking about a woman in the background. She said, I never told her about the Depression. She would have worried. Mm. And it's interesting because people think of the Depression as one downswing, but really it hit bottom in 1932. And if you had invested in the stock market between 32 and 34, you'd make a lot of money.
You've said, Bob, that you feel upbeat when times are downbeat.
Well, I think that's one of the functions of humor. I mean, the laughter of good times is just, you know, sort of frat boy laughter, right? We're all having a good time. We're laughing, and that's a great point. That's great. You know, it's congenial. We're at a party, and we're all laughing. But one of the functions of humor is its coping function, a way to sort of reframe things that look tragic but actually aren't tragic. We're in a difficult situation, but that situation is not actually a tragedy. And, you know, that's one of the functions of humor, to be able to reframe it, to give us some perspective on events.
A few of the cartoons, Bob, feature Wall Streeters jumping out of windows.
What's very interesting about that, there were no cartoons like that until 1959.
Is that right?
Yeah, you see, so it's sort of, you know, tragedy plus time, you know, the old formula.
So it was hard to make fun of that earlier on.
Yeah, absolutely. It was hard to make fun of it. And I mean, comedy and humor always requires, you know, some distance, you know, in our own lives, we know that. You know, when we're having a terrible vacation because we can't find the luggage and it goes from one place to another, the moment then we're in the airport looking for the luggage and it's, you know, say in some other country, we're not happy. 2 years later, that's a funny anecdote.
Well, then let me ask you, because as we all know, a lot of people lost money because of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Is it okay to make fun of that in a cartoon?
Certainly. I mean, those are things that are absolutely okay to make fun of, because it's not just Bernie Madoff, but it's people's own credulity, their foibles. I mean, one of the functions of humor, besides having a good time, is really satire, a type of corrective for our failings, for our foibles, you know, pointing out to, you know, our own stupidity. So we were all part and parcel of this. The people who invested money with Bernie Madoff are that's very tragic for them, and what he did was criminal and deserves criminal penalties. What they did deserves frankly some ridicule.
Which cartoon do you think does the best job of summing up people's feelings about the economy?
I don't think any one cartoon, because the economy, I think, changes so much. You know, you might have a cartoon after the 2001 dot-com crash where, you know, this guy morosely, you know, saying, I want my bubble back. You might have a cartoon right before that when everyone was investing in the dot-com, where there's two beggars and one, there's two hats, and one of them is sort of an empty hat, and the other says beggar.com, and it's full of money. you know, I did a cartoon, and this goes back to 1988, shows you how these things come around again and again, where a guy is saying, you know, I'd like a hedge fund against my hedge funds. I think the cartoons, there's no one cartoon because there's no one economy.
Well, the one that sums it up for me, Bob, is the one that features two dogs walking down the street, and one dog says to the other dog, let's face it, man's best friend is money.
You know, I did a cartoon like that where a father is telling his kid perception isn't reality, money is. Another cartoon like that that I actually did is a guy on a psychiatrist saying to the shrink, okay, money isn't the only thing. Now, what's the other thing again? So there are a lot of cartoons like that.
There's a cartoon from the 1930s that I love. It's of a woman sitting on her husband's lap at the theater, and yeah. She leans over and says to the other woman next to her, we're on a budget.
You can see where a cartoon like that, you know, could reflect what's happening now with everyone being, you know, very, very conscious of saving. There's a cartoon from the 70s by Joseph Farris in which there's a guy at the dinner table with his children and wife and saying, because of inflation, I'm going to have to let two of you go.
Mm. The book is On the Money, The Economy in Cartoons, 1925 to 2009. Bob Mankoff, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
On the Money is out now from Andrews McMeel Publishing. A new book and exhibit captures New York City's wild side. And we're not talking about what happens at the bars on a Saturday night. Photographer Joel Meyerowitz has put together a collection of images featuring hidden pockets of wilderness throughout the city. It's the first photographic study of the city's parks since the 1930s. I gave Joel a call to learn more about it. Joel, let's start at the beginning. You were born in the Bronx in 1938. You were raised here in the 1940s and 50s. You have called yourself an urban Huckleberry Finn and have referred to the Bronx River as your Mississippi.
Yeah, well, a tributary of the Bronx River ran right along the empty lots in my neighborhood when I was a kid. And many times the gang of us, would just walk the river or set traps. You know, we all were Boy Scouts, and we learned how to make bird traps and animal traps, and we caught snakes and rabbits and turtles and some small birds, you know, not to do anything with them, but just to see if we could catch them and then let them go. And once, it took us probably 3 weeks, we built a raft out of scraps from some construction that was nearby, and we poled and pushed and carried this raft from where we lived, which was right near the elevated train tracks, all the way out to the East River and the Long Island Sound in a place called Sound View in the Bronx. And it was one of those things, it took us days to do it, but we managed to do it, and it was one of those unforgettable childhood memories.
So it sounds like the city's natural environment has always been a big part of your life.
Certainly growing up as a kid in those far reaches of the Bronx, not far from Pelham Bay, it was really rural. And, you know, what do you know as a kid? You're growing up in a tenement, and outside is this free, wild space, and you think that's what life is. And only later did I realize that New York was a different, you know, more urban, dense environment.
Now, here you are many years later capturing New York City's natural environment on film.
It turned out to be a wonderful opportunity. You know, I was the only photographer that was allowed inside Ground Zero, and I spent 9 months in there making an archive of what it looked like in the recovery efforts and the rebuilding efforts. And it was a very emotionally, you know, profound experience. And when I came out of that, I realized that I'm at an age where I want to do more socially useful works. Along came Commissioner Benepe, head of the Parks and Recreation Department, and he asked if I would be interested in making some kind of a document about the parks that it hadn't been documented seriously since the WPA in the 30s, the last depression. I said, yeah, let me take a look. I'll go to some parks and see what it is I should do here. Because I thought really what my job would be to do an accounting of all of the assets that all the parks have. And frankly, that wasn't so stimulating to me. But in every park I went, there was some place in the park that had a kind of unmanaged and wild nature. And I thought, that's it for me. This is where I'm drawn to. And why shouldn't I document this thing, which is such a contradiction? You don't think of New York's parks as having wilderness areas in them. And so it became my cause, in a way. And now the archive is complete, at least at this moment, and it has about 3,500 photographs in it.
Forest Park is a pretty miraculous place. It reminds me of the Redwood Forest in California.
It's true. There's a quality in there where one could get lost in the pine barrens of that park, where the scale isn't quite the Redwood scale, but the impression when you're in there is that you are a solitary who found your way into this incredibly fragrant, glowing, red-floored zone of pine trees. And, you know, to sit down on the forest floor and just put your back against a tree and read a book, it's spiritual. It's really a wonderful spiritual opportunity.
And where is that park for those who are not familiar with it?
Well, it's pretty much in the center of Queens, easy enough to get to. Any map will show it. You can Google it on the web, and it'll tell you what train you need to take to get to it.
One of your photos, Joel, captures a place called High Rock Park, and you've captured it in the spring. To me, it looks more like Mississippi than New York City.
Yeah, you go up into these places, and not only are the woods dense and there are hiking trails through them, but they have these hidden ponds low down. Somehow, it's a very high place, but probably these are glacial leftovers called kettle ponds. When the glaciers retreated 10,000 years ago, they sometimes left off some chunk of ice that ultimately created a deep sink, you might say, from which springs would flow. And these ponds are hidden away in the woods, and they're sublime to come upon. And you know, and there's on any given day, you might find it fog-bound inside these woods, and you think you're in, you know, a deep southern region.
There are two places where people can experience the parks through your photographs. One is the book called Legacy, and the other is this exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York, right?
Yep, and it has about 90 photographs in them, most of them large-scale pictures, and some of them immense. Rather than looking at a conventional picture that's 20 inches across, I wanted visitors to come in and experience the scale of nature inside the rooms of a building so that it might communicate something about what we have in New York, what our legacy really is.
Joel, thanks so much for your time.
George, thank you very much for doing this. My best.
Joel Meyerowitz is an award-winning photographer. You can check out his latest work in an exhibit at the Museum of the City of New York called Legacy, the Preservation of Wilderness in New York City Parks. He also has a new book out with the same title. You're tuned to Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Good morning once again. I'm George Boldarkey.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
He calls himself the Slice Harvester, and he's roaming the streets of New York City with a purpose. He's looking for the perfect slice, according to him. He's got a blog, and he's not pulling any punches. He's slightly prickly, mostly outspoken, and definitely on a mission. We hung out with him to see what his process is.
My name is Colin, and I'm slowly but surely eating a slice of pizza at every pizzeria in New York City.
It seems like this is a sort of homage to New York City pizza.
Yeah, absolutely. I got this Daily News article, you know, and they ran like some kind of variation on it in some Italian, maybe print publication, definitely a website, and I've been getting like dozens of emails every day from people in Naples telling me that the slices on my website look disgusting and that if I want real pizza, I should come to Naples. I can stay at their house. They'll make me a pizza. And they're missing the point. It's two different foods. I'm going to take a bite of this because it looks delicious.
Go ahead. So we're at Pugsley's in the Bronx, right here outside of the gates of Fordham University. You are trying a plain slice.
Oh, good God, this is a good slice of pizza.
What's your criteria for a good slice of pizza?
It's pretty simple. But, like most simple things, it's almost impossible to achieve. I'm not such a good measurer by eye, but if you notice the shape of this slice from a side view, that the dough, the bread part, is about a centimeter thick, would you say? And then it bubbles out at the crust to like 2 to 3 times as thick. And that's very important. The bottom is crunchy. It cracks when you fold it, which is a crucial element. It's like partially blackened from being cooked so much, and you can taste the like sort of crispy burntness. Not burnt in a bad way, like when the cheese gets all burnt and hard and haggard, but shouldn't be too much sauce. Your slice shouldn't be too wet, and the sauce shouldn't taste like canned pureed tomatoes. The cheese should be congealed enough that it's a solid mass, but not so congealed that it's it doesn't run and get sort of stringy as you bite into it. Adequate amounts of salt.
Did you think this much about pizza before you started this project, or did that all come into being as you went along?
I don't think I know anyone who doesn't think this much about pizza. I go to pizza places with my friends, and we sit, we order a slice, and we sit in the pizzeria, and we talk about all the other slices of pizza we've ever had. Pizza, as a topic of conversation, comes up in my life so frequently, it's ridiculous. It's a fantastic thing.
What do you say then to people who say a slice is a slice is a slice?
They're wrong.
Well, how does this slice compare to others that you have tried so far?
This is like a solidly good slice. It's like everything you want out of a slice of pizza that you're going to get on the street. It's not mind-blowing or anything, but it's like it's really, really good, you know?
And how many have you tried so far?
I think about 50, give or take.
And of the 50, how many would you say were just plain bad?
Bad? Outright bad? Maybe 5 to 10.
That's not bad.
No, but like maybe 6 of them were good. You know what I mean? And the rest of them exist in that nebulous region of totally unexceptional and mediocre.
There are thousands of pizza places in New York City. How do you even go about locating them all to do this kind of project? As you chew.
Yeah, excuse me. I use the phone book on the internet.
Are you afraid you might miss some?
No, I'm not. When I was first up in Inwood, like on my first couple weeks going out, I thought, there can't be this few pizzerias around here. And I just walked, because Inwood's small. I walked back and forth across all of Inwood onto every single street, every avenue. And there was not a single pizzeria that wasn't listed on the internet phone book.
So how long do you think this will take you to finish?
The whole project?
Yeah.
At the rate that I'm going, 6.5 to 7.5 years.
What is the rate that you're going?
About seven, average 7 slices a week.
7 slices a week.
So like 6 to 9 slices a week, really.
How many in any given day?
Well, I go once a week, and I eat 6 to 9 slices in one day.
How many calories are in the average slice? Do you know?
Wait, I'm not a scientist or a nutritionist.
I read about 300 calories.
Well, I'll take your word for it. I have no idea.
Are you afraid of getting fat?
No. No, not at all. Look, I'm probably eating the same amount of pizza I was eating in a week before. And I wasn't afraid of getting fat then.
Do you ever get tired of pizza?
No. I've been eating pizza many times a week since I was like 10 years old. I'm not tired yet.
And where are you from?
I'm from New York.
Where in New York?
Keeping it mysterious. We're keeping it all mysterious.
Why are you keeping it mysterious, by the way?
I don't know. It seems fun.
And plain slices only in this project?
Yeah. What if I went to this place and I said, what kind of slice do you guys make the best? And I had a grandma slice here, and then I compared that to like a broccoli rabe and onion slice at some other place, and then I compared that to a pepperoni slice. What the hell's going on there?
And what about your Domino's or your Sbarro's?
Nope.
Are you familiar with Julie and Julia, the movie, the woman who decided to do a Julia Child's recipe every day and then blog about it? Then she got a book deal and, of course, the big blockbuster hit with Meryl Streep.
No, I heard of it after people kept comparing me to it.
Are you hoping for a book deal, though, Colin?
That would be cool. I'm not. I can't say I'm hoping for it. I mean, I guess maybe I'm hoping for it. Am I expecting it? No. Was that why I started doing this? Absolutely not.
Colin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find Colin's blog at sliceharvester.blogspot.com. Well, they're just two guys from the neighborhood, and they've brought back old-fashioned soda. It's called Bronx Pop, and it's making some waves. The soda may be new, but it borrows from the old, apparently made with real cane sugar. It has less carbonation, fewer calories, and it's green to boot. We talked to the local boys earlier this week to find out what all the fizz is about. Joining us now on Cityscape is Nikki D'Aragano and Ralph Rubino. They are the creators of this new soda, Bronx Pop. Hey, guys.
How are you?
How you doing?
Good. I want to try to, you know, make sure we know who's who. So why don't we start off with you, Nikki. Tell us about Bronx Pop.
It's an old-time fountain soda made with natural cane sugar, low sodium, no caffeine, natural spring water. It's bottled in glass bottles only.
Why glass bottles only?
We want to do our bit for the environment. So it's a recycled bottle, recycled label, recycled packaging, even our bottle caps are, we bought them from a closeout.
Is that right?
Yes.
So no plastic in the waste stream?
No plastic. And then another thing with plastic, when plastic gets hot, it changes the composition and flavor.
Is that right?
Yes, it does.
How so?
There's a, you know, a little bit of release of chemical that goes into the flavoring, especially if it gets, you know, 90, 95, you know, when it's on a hot truck, you can taste the difference.
How much research did you do before bottling this soda?
We did a lot. A lot of back and forth, a lot of arguments, a lot of jokes along the way, a couple bangs and bruises.
So, Ralph, how did the idea come about?
Well, me and Nikki were sitting on, in front of my house one night, and it was in the summer.
You were stooping.
Yeah, we were stooping.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm from the Bronx.
We,
I know stooping.
We were reminiscing about when we were kids going to the candy store and getting real fountain soda, you know. We wanted to reproduce it. Nobody has soda like that anymore. Whatever competitors we have out there now to use high fructose corn syrup, stuff leaves a bad taste in your mouth, you know. And we wanted a real authentic old-fashioned soda.
So who mixed this up for you?
There was a third party involved. We sent up down the basement. He'd come up with a batch. We'd send him back down, you know. It went off for a couple of months.
A lot of tasting, a lot of different flavors. I think that's where I gained all the weight, tasting all the soda.
Yeah, we were skinny when we started.
Yeah, that's true.
But this soda is a little more low-cal than most sodas,
yes,
right?
It is.
Because of the cane sugar.
It's not overly sweetened.
It's not overly sweetened. It's not overly carbonated. You can eat that with a nice hero and not feel full afterward.
I'll tell you, Ralph, you kind of scare me with that accent when you say, you know, we sent him down into the basement.
Oh, that's where he had to go. We told him, don't come up until it's right.
Who was your mixologist?
We don't want to mention his name because he might get a little mad at us.
Yeah.
How long did it take to perfect the flavors?
It took a few months.
Yeah, a few months.
About 6 months.
What was that place that you guys hung out at as kids?
Well, there was a couple of them. Right on 187th Street and Arthur Avenue, there was a few candy stores. And there was ice cream parlor up on Fordham Road, Jan's. That was real popular. They sold soda and ice cream, you know.
So did you test this out on people in the neighborhood, especially old-timers, to say, do you remember this flavor?
Yes,
you got
we
this?
Did.
We did that at the Ferragosta.
What's the Ferragosta?
The Ferragosta is the street fair on Arthur Avenue. What was it, about a month ago?
Yeah.
You should really check it out. All the vendors from Arthur Avenue get on this one street. They close the street down. There's entertainment. Movie stars show up. It's a nice...
It's like an end of the summer festival.
It's an end of
summer,
one-day
festival, you know.
So who showed up?
Chaz Palminteri.
A lot of the old singing groups, doo-wop groups and stuff.
Did they try Bronx Pop?
They sure did.
They sure did.
We got nothing but good reviews.
Are they going to be your spokespeople?
Well, we had one group that was interested in doing that, but we don't want to jump into bed with just anybody.
Yeah.
Which group was that?
I'd rather not say, because we don't want to hurt their feelings.
We don't want to hurt their feelings right now.
So not exactly the face of Bronx Pop? Is that what was going on there?
It could have been, but maybe... You know, maybe a prettier girl will come along. You know what I mean?
Who would be your ideal? You know, J-Lo's from the Bronx, you know.
There you go. Right now, we'd even settle for Penny Marshall. She's from the Bronx.
Yeah, hey, you know, Laverne, she could mix Bronx Pop milk.
That's right up our alley.
Forget milk and Pepsi, milk and Bronx Pop.
That's right.
I understand that the Bronx Borough President gave you a ringing
endorsement. Yeah,
yeah,
yes, he did.
You know, got some penciled in plans at this point, but nothing definite.
What do you mean by plans?
Well, eventually we'd like to put a bottling facility in the Bronx.
Is that right?
And bring jobs to the Bronx and really, because the Bronx really embraced this. A lot of the communities embraced the whole concept. You know, maybe a 2-3 year plan. We would love to put a plant together and, you know, create a good probably 30-40 jobs easy.
And where here can we get it? Around the neighborhood?
You can go to Joe's Deli, Ivana's Pizza.
A couple of the other bodegas,
which you never know what names they have, but, you know, you just know that they're there. You know, there's a couple. There's probably a good 10, 15.
It's available on Morris Park.
Williamsbridge Road. You can come to where our office is and our mini warehouse.
Let me ask you this. Can Bronx Pop sell in Brooklyn?
We've gotten calls.
Yeah? Yep.
Absolutely.
Right.
Not from Marty Markowitz, I wouldn't think, the borough president.
we got calls from Brooklyn. We got calls from Bayonne, New Jersey, Staten Island.
Are you the only borough-specific soda that you're aware of?
Nah, there's another brand out there from one of the other boroughs that we ain't too crazy about.
So we won't even mention
one of the other boroughs.
But our stuff is better than theirs anyway.
Yeah.
How many flavors are there right now?
Right now, there's grape, orange cream, lemon lime Ricky, root beer,
black cherry.
We're coming out with a regular cream, a sugar-free cream. Eventually, there'll be a diet orange cream, probably a diet root beer, and a diet black cherry. And then eventually, hopefully...
Don't even say it.
Okay.
Because somebody will steal the idea from us.
Yeah, we can't tell you. We have a crowning...
We got a secret weapon.
We got a crowning development that should be out by the first of the year.
Are you at all afraid of the big, bad health department? Because you know they have this whole new campaign to avoid sugary drinks.
You know what? They need to worry about the soda companies that are using high fructose corn syrup, not pure cane sugar.
And bentonite and everything else that they put in there.
We don't have any of that in our soda.
None of that stuff is in there.
I see you drink a bottle of our soda and take a walk around the block and it's gone.
And yours
burn
is
that
not
sugar right off.
Yours is not as carbonated, am I right?
No, that's exactly right, because that's true to what a soda fountain was one. They use soda water. Soda water, you know, brings out more flavor.
We were told our soda is very drinkable.
Yeah.
Now you're saying soda.
Right.
This is called Bronx Pop.
That's right.
Well, the pop part came out because in one of our heated discussions, our mixer guy was like, well, how about we come out with a Hawaiian flavor? And we're like, well, how about we give you a pop? And that's where Bronx Pop came from.
Have you guys known each other forever?
A long time. Yeah. We're related. We're cousins.
You're cousins.
Yeah, right.
So it's all in the family.
Absolutely.
That's what we said.
All right. Is there anything else about this Bronx Pop? I mean,
The one thing I like to say is we could use some salesmen. We need sales help. You know, me and Nicky can't do it all. We need a little help.
You know, that's nice to hear. You know, with unemployment going past 10% here in New York City.
You know, somebody's got a van and they're looking to get involved, give us a call and be happy to put them to work.
Absolutely.
Now, talk to me more about the marketing, because you are saying that you're doing this largely by word of mouth right now.
Absolutely.
Right.
It seems like it's working to some extent.
Yes,
but
it is.
Do you need to do more? What's next?
Well, right now our advertising
budget is very low.
It's pretty much non-existent.
Yeah.
We got all the money tied up in the product.
In the product and, you know.
And it's not tied up on the outside of the bottle. Everything is inside the bottle.
I'm going to try what's inside the bottle.
Why do we want you to?
You twist it with a Bronx attitude, though.
Twist it with a Bronx attitude. Now, how do you twist it? I'm from the Bronx, by the way. I had to work really hard to lose the accent that you guys have to work on radio. I'm kind of missing it right now, though, hearing you talk. Yeah.
Come and hang out with us. We'll make sure you get it.
I'm twisting it with the Bronx attitude. You know?
Very good.
I know?
Very good.
It's good, and it's not too carbonated, and I enjoy
it's
that as well.
It's very drinkable, right?
It's very drinkable.
There you
exactly.
go. Now all you need is a slice of pizza, and you're
You'd
in business.
You'll be set to go.
There you go. Nicky, Ralph, thank you so much. Can I call you Ralphie?
Oh, I'm Ralphie.
Can I call you Ralphie?
Yes, you can.
All right, Nicky, Ralphie.
That's right.
That's the way we are.
Thank you. A couple
of neighborhood guys, that's it.
Start spreading the news.
If you want to pay the boys a visit, go to bronxpop.com. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. I'm George Bodarkey. My thanks to producer Skylar Srivastava. Have a great weekend. New York.